Okay, good morning. Well, maybe while we wait another couple of minutes, if there are questions from last time, I guess it's a good time. Because today we're changing topic a little bit, so for the last two lectures.
What are we going to talk about?
So we talked about the covariant phase space in terms of the space of histories. We went on Schell and so on and so forth, and claimed, oh, this should be a bit like phase space. Today we are going to explore that part of the question.
I have a half question, which is that we usually think of temperature of black holes in terms of like going to the Euclidean space. Having curiosity. Is there like a connection to the kappa, like in history?
I don't know. For me, that's it's a. I think for me, I don't know. It's a bit of a mystery why the Hawking streak of Euclideanizing and doing this kind of weak rotation actually gives you the right temperature. There is the usual argument is to say, oh, if you're doing QFT and you want to study thermal states, that's exactly what you have to do. But in GR, since you do not have an obvious time coordinate, and to do that trick, you're picking one particular time coordinate, which is adapted to Schwarzschild or for example. And so you're Euclideanizing somehow your coordinates, not so much the geom. Like it's a bit unclear what all of that means at the level of geometries and how to go beyond certain very specific types of spacetime. And without understanding that, and maybe it's me. I don't. Maybe there are better answers out there. But without the better understanding of that connection, I'm not sure how to relate. The surface gravity as we defined it to the Euclidean story, which of course doesn't mean it's not possible, but I don't have a good answer. Okay, so as I just hinted to, today we're changing topic. We're going back to the general question of what is the relationship between the covariant phase space and the canonical phase space. I hope to be fast enough to get by the end of the course to talk about this canonical symmetry algebra of general relativity, because it has a complicated and very interesting structure. So, but first we need to go through this more general step to see how it works in simple cases before doing the hardest one. So, from covariant to canonical. So, this is the theme. So let me do one drawing which is relevant, which is our usual potato spacetimes. So we have an initial a sigma. And some n and some m. So the focus will be on, of course, by conventions, on the initial sigma with its time-like normal. So here we're working with Cauchy surfaces, and we're interested we will be interested in the initial value problem. So we completely forget about corners. We want something that is nicely behaved. So we want a full Cauchy surface over here, and it's time evolution.
Last question, find that there is no corner?
Sorry?
Does Cauchy imply that there is no corner?
Well, otherwise you have to put boundary conditions and check that your equations of motion. It's much easier to have a closed universe. So you just check that you have hyperbolic equations.
And so it doesn't imply, but that's the way you phrase it.
If you have boundaries without boundary conditions, then you will have things leaking out and possibly leaking in, which is the worst part, degrees of freedom that can leak in. So you will not have an autonomous system. So you have to specify boundary conditions to make sense of your equations of motion. And I don't want to talk about boundary conditions. So I will take a closed universe. Okay. In this way, things cannot go anywhere. They can just evolve inside. There's nothing that can come in. If you put reflecting boundary conditions, that's fine. That's okay, but then you have to do more work. And in field theory, it might be a bit hard.
So the absence of corners makes sigma and pushes on this.
Together with the theory, well, yeah, in usual, for the usual physical theory, it does. You also need to know, sorry?
I was going to say you have the t equals 0, slice of Minkowski or something, that would also be
yeah, with, but you would put usually fast full off
yes.
conditions or something,
but
right?
It would have corners though, and it would be a I think that was probably.
The fact that it doesn't have corners, I mean, you can take a sphere. Doesn't.
Yeah. No, okay. The question is why this cannot be R3. And it can be R3, but you're secretly putting some boundary conditions there, which could be fast full off or something else. Okay. And basically, it's making sure that things is not coming in from infinity without you realizing it and destroying predictability. Okay. And this is especially important if you have massless degrees of freedom that can come in from past infinity, right? More than time-like, or well, anyway, it's.
But are you not also like? I mean, I agree that probably should do first without boundary condition, but like, you know, gravitons, like the degrees of freedom of gravity coming from infinity.
So, okay, this would be a bit of a longer debate, but. Asymptotic infinity, it's in my opinion, and I think in the opinion, and I think Penrose, when he wrote the original papers, was thinking in the same way. That type of infinity was introduced as a way to model isolated systems, not so much as a model of the entire universe. So it's good to do physics in those conditions, and you have to put initial boundary conditions and null infinity that tells you what's coming in, and then you have future null infinity, which is done in a nice way so that things can only go out from there, so that then you have only outfluxes of energy by the way, but not by design is a result, but it means that things are well behaved. In ADS, you might have harder problems because you don't have these nice null structures, but it's time-like, the asymptotic infinity, and then people put reflecting boundary conditions there to make the system well-behaved and autonomous. So it becomes very complicated and very specific to the kind of situation you're looking at, so it's much easier to just say there are no boundaries and forget about those problems for now. Okay, so here we had our space of fields, of field configurations, of shell, and we had an omega, which was our covariant symplectic density. And we could define these as, you know, a top minus 1 comma 2 form on spacetime. So here we're working really on M. Inside here, we saw that there is the space of on shell history that satisfy the equations of motion. And what we did was to pull back to, so this is the Euler Lagrange locus, so on shell, Euler Lagrange locus. So we just pull back our form to that field, and we kind of hand-wavingly said, oh, this really looks like the canonical phase space. So we expect that there is a relationship between the two. But we know that the canonical phase space is defined on an hypersurface, so at the level of sigma. Let's say sigma in, just to make things a bit more explicit. And so the question is, here I have my, where do I want to write it? Well, let me write it here for now, then we will update this graph. So the question is, how do we go, well, actually. So how do we go from, and this is my canonical phase space, How do we go from up here to down here? So it's best to work by examples. Example one. And then I will generalize to a general recipe, which is mathematically rigorous. So the first example is the particle. And the particle, we see it as a zero plus one dimensional field theory. So S, let's say, of gamma t, or gamma tau, if you want to use that type of, let's make things simple and work in with the usual time. So here we have m over gamma dot square minus v of gamma t. So this is our system. And now we know that F is the space of maps from R, well, let's say, from R into R3, for example, right? And omega is delta gamma t delta gamma dot wedge delta gamma t. So let me write it actually as like this. So this is the covariant phase space structure for this system. Should I derive it, or is it clear how it works? Should be clear, right? Okay, so here we are inside here. Then we can go on shell, and to do that, we need to pick the solutions of the equations of motion inside these sets of maps, and then pull this back here. This makes gamma dot depend. It makes gamma and gamma dot not independent anymore, but. So this is very complicated. How do I write it explicitly? How do I even deal with this object explicitly? We use it to do some computations. For example, the world story. We were working in here. But you see, if you want to find out a phase space, it's very hard to work at this level. So that's why this is useful, because this space is extremely abstract. So the trick is to say, okay, we want a map if the equations of motion are nice, there is a map between histories, well, on-shell histories, and the initial conditions. At some sigma in. So the idea is to use this relationship. So we want to take these structures and pull them back to sigma. So as we know, these well, here is not super clear, but omega, this is something we use plenty of times, so it should be clear, is a 2 form on F, but is a top minus 1 form on M. So it really wants to be integrated over sigma, right? So this means so here, what we do is to say, OK, let's start with sigma in being the surface at t equal t naught. And at this point, we can define our omega sigma, as we already did. So this is essentially, well, here is a point, right? Because we are in 0 plus 1 dimensions. So omega sigma is just the the valuation of omega, in this case, at t equal to 0. And we get d of gamma dot at t naught wedge the variation of gamma at t naught. Now, heuristically, we see that these, we really would like to call these this quantity Q and this quantity P. Why are we justified to do that? Well, the reason is the following. This omega sigma is still defined on F. It's still eating objects in F. But remark, omega sigma has a huge kernel in F. So how does it work? So let's say that X belongs to the kernel of omega sigma if and only if I X omega sigma is equal to 0. So if I write X as this is essentially some delta gamma of t integrated over t of delta gamma t. So so what is the point? The point is I claim that this happens if and only if. So this is just a side note for the notation. If and only if delta x gamma t naught equal delta x dt of delta x gamma at t naught is equal 0. So these are very small conditions on something that is, in fact, a function. Well, I could have written it maybe with the parentheses outside, a function of t. So here I'm just, x belongs to the kernel as soon as these two values are fixed to 0. So it means that any two histories gamma t1 and gamma 2t
with the same value of gamma 1 t naught and gamma dot 1 t naught,
are in the same lie along the flow of the kernel of omega. So if I want a symplectic object, I need to identify all these configurations. If I want a symplectic space. Just a second.
So symplectic, remember, means non-degenerate space P. I need to identify all these configurations. So what is, and then I find the equivalent classes Q and P, which are given by. So if I define, how do I write it? So P becomes the space of equivalent classes of gamma t, such that,
sorry, let me write it in steps.
I define these labeled by Q and P as the equivalence class, such that these are all the gammas in F, such that gamma t0 is equal to Q and gamma dot t0 is equal to P. Well, maybe I put an M just for consistency. Yes?
Well, why is the variation of gamma with respect to x equal to the partial derivative of, equal to the variation of gamma, but with the partial derivative with time?
Here?
Yeah.
Oh, because when I contract in here, if when I contract x with this, I find this object multiplying delta x gamma at t naught and vice versa this other one. And the only way for that to be identically zero is that the coefficients are zero independently.
So that should be bold d and not delta.
No. So this is about x. The notation is always a little. So x is in the kernel if and only if its component so satisfies these two properties. This is about x. So when I compute this object and I find that it's identically zero as a one form. Maybe this is one, as a one form. So suppose I'm contracting just with the second term for a second. So I get, with the first term. I find this, which depend on my choice of x, multiplying delta gamma. Delta gamma t naught. But gamma t naught on f can take any value that I like. It's a one form that is free, that there's no constraint on. So the only way for this object to be zero is that the coefficient, which is this one, vanishes. It's like saying, let me do a simpler example. So I have. I have x, which is xi, x1 d dx,
plus x2 d dy plus x3 d dz. And my omega is just the x dy. What is the condition that Ix omega is equal to 0? Is that the coefficient, so I contract these, I get x1 dy. So this is x1 dy, oops, plus minus x2 dx, and that's it. So the condition here is that x1 equal x2 equals 0. And x3 is completely free. So here is the same. The condition for this to be in the kernel is that the coefficients that matter when I contract it are 0, which are the value of the variation at t naught and its time derivative of t naught. But everything else is free, which is the analog of x3 over there. And therefore, it means that any two points in R3 which are connected by a vector field along the z-axis are related by, so omega in R, as a function, as a two form in R3 is degenerate. So how do I find something non-degenerate? By identifying all objects, all points along the flow in the third direction. So this is my z-axis. And omega in here is degenerate, but if I identify them, so project them, this is the mathematical procedure there of finding equivalence classes, which are labeled by x and y only, it will be non-degenerate here. And indeed, the x, the y is non-degenerate on R2. You can also think of fixing a time, like a slice here, because the situation is simple. But more generally, you want to identify all the objects along these flows of the kernel.
I was confused because x is basically a vector field in phase space. It's mm-hmm. a partial derivative with gamma and also gamma dot.
But yeah. Delta x gamma is the full history. So you can take also time derivative of the history. That tells you how gamma dot will change by a next variation. Does that make sense? Yeah? OK. So now we have that we can label P. So we define P. So this P is essentially F. In fact, I should call it, well, then let's think about this in a second. F modulo the kernel of omega sigma. I should put a sigma here, but I will not, because in reality, it does not really depend on which sigma I'm choosing. And in this case, I find that this is the space of Qs and Ps. And it's a finite dimensional space because it's just R2. It's a particle, so it's simple enough. So this is very much the analog of what is happening in this picture. This is F, and this is P. Except that Z here is an infinite dimensional direction, because it's all histories that do not match at this very single time value will be identified. So I should call this P off if I want to be fully honest, because I've never used the equations of motion. And this is the general formula I want to use. Now, this procedure of removing the kernel of omega f of omega sigma is called presymplectic reduction. So this procedure here is called presymplectic reduction. because you start from something that is not symplectic, so you call it presymplectic because it has a kernel, and you remove the kernel, and that's why you reduce. So that's why it's called this way. And so we have that we can go from here to here through presymplectic reduction. Which is, so I should call this omega f, which I will write in a second, but is the obvious guess. This is removing the kernel of omega sigma. So on P off, omega sigma induces what is by construction non-degenerate, a non-degenerate two form, which I define, which I call omega f. And in this case, well, usually it's pretty simple. Once you write it, we call this a q, and this was p. So it's just delta p delta q. Of course, this d in this example is finite dimensional. Is on a finite dimensional space. So it's the usual d in reality. I just keep it because in field theory this will be deltas. Okay? But so it's for consistency with laser, but this is just the usual two form on R2. At this point, one last remark. It seems that we have been lucky. Because although we worked off shell, we ended up on the space of initial conditions for our system in the Hamiltonian picture. But this is the space of initial condition for our system. So let me write it in small here. We were lucky. P's and Q's are also in one-to-one correspondence with on-shell histories. We never used it as an input, but it seems that it worked, at least in this case. So I should maybe add, I will rewrite it more nicely at the end. But in this case, for the particle, we find that this is also the one that we would have found by coming from there and doing presymplectic reduction from this level. So this is let's say the lucky case. So why we were lucky is we were lucky because there are no gauge symmetries. So if we were to work at the level of on-shell histories, you would have to work a bit harder to make sense of this procedure because you would have to look at the kernel in the space of on-shells of solutions of your equations of motion and so on and so forth. But in fact, since you know how to parameterize those solutions in the particle case, you can just see that the answer is the right one. So there's no point in really trying hard to understand this arrow. We can just remark that in this case it works. So here we have the particle is among this. We could repeat this exercise for other theories. I will do it. Is the particle clear? Yeah.
So we say that we can play the game by the off-cell and the on-cell space in the field
field space, and the lucky case here is that they are equal because we don't have gauge symmetry. So
yeah, that's what we will. Yeah, I will go there in a moment.
Yeah, I'm just trying to understand.
Yeah,
add gauge symmetries, we can still play the same game, but then to get the equality, we need to remove more stuff.
It's, yeah, basically.
Okay.
The diagram becomes a bit more complicated, in fact. The left-hand side works the same way as the right-hand side, that and the relationship between... So P off will have a very different meaning. It will be not directly related to your solutions. There's too much in it, and so you will have to remove it. And we're going there in a second. I just want to make the point before doing the gauge theory that for a scalar field theory, things work exactly like in the particle case. Yes?
Can I say in this case that going on shell and monogon by the kernel commute?
So we could say, we could, okay, a better diagram. Let me do the part, let's write it like this. F for particle and scalar field theory as examples. What happens is that we start from our off shell story. We do presymplectic reduction. This is modulo the kernel of omega sigma. And so here we are in M. Here we have picked a sigma to do this. So this is presymplectic reduction, this arrow. Inside here, we have the space of on-shell histories. Let me just write and here we can do presymplectic reduction here too, right? Formally, nothing changes. It's just more complicated to perform. And here we find always what we want to call our phase space. So this is, in fact, our definition of what the right phase space is, no matter what. So because we find something that is knows about the on-shell condition, so we only get the physical stuff. And it's omega will be non-degenerate by construction. So this is always the right the physical, maybe I should call it the physical phase space. And now in here, these two, the question is, how are they related in general? And it turns out that in the particle case, the question mark is actually an isomorphism. Yes?
Well, why is it an isomorphism? Should we not impose E equals zero?
So it's down here, not up there. Mm-hmm. We have seen that in the particle case, here we found just P's and Q's. And there is one P and one Q for each story in here. This is a way, way, way larger space. But by virtue of having restricted to sigma, removed and identified all these many, many histories, all the histories, off-shell histories, that do not have the same P and Q have been identified. So this, I'm identifying lots of stuff that has nothing to do with the shell condition. But it turns out that what I obtain in the end is a space of P's and Q's. And this is in one-to-one correspondence. Each of the points in this space corresponds to one here in a unique way. And if I were to... These are the same P's and Q's that would appear on the on-shell structure, of course. And so these two spaces are isomorphic in that case. But I'm using the fact that I know how to solve the equations of motion.
So we don't impose equations of motion, we just do presyntactic
direction. On the left-hand side.
Yes, but P and Q automatically satisfy.
Exactly. So in that sense, we were lucky in this case. It doesn't have to work a priori, but it does. For the scalar field theory, the story is exactly the same. Why? Because we have phi r, in this case, maps from M into R. And omega is the let's write directly omega sigma. Omega sigma is the integral over sigma of dn delta phi of t wedge delta phi of x and t naught of x and t naught, right? If sigma is the t equal t naught slice. And n is the normal in that sense. So here what I could do if I wanted to be a bit. So this is the metric on. Let me write it more covariantly, it's a bit nicer. This becomes. The normal derivative NH is the induced metric on the surface. This is what I would find if I integrate omega sigma. And now presymplectic reduction gives me P of omega of, which is the same as the true one. And what is it given? P of is given by equivalence classes of phi of x and t, such that phi at t zero x is some phi of x, and square root of h dn phi t naught of x is some pi of x. So phi and so this is the space, if you want, of phi and pi, which are functions. So this is a function on sigma, and this is a density on sigma. So momenta. Usually, we take this out of pi because it's a bit easier when the background is fixed. But in principle, if you want to be mathematically more rigorous, or I don't know, in GR you kind of are forced because H would be part of your phase space, so you have to reabsorb it. You cannot just have it pull it out freely. So in general, it's good to think about momenta as densities. Densities means that they're not scalar functions like this would be. They have this volume factor in front, which doesn't transform as a scalar, it transforms like a volume element. So they're called densities. So this is what I've put here. This is what it makes it a density. But beside that, these phi and p are the same canonical variables that you would find in the usual picture, and you can have an Hamiltonian formulation for the fields, and this would be given in terms of phi and pi. Of course, the problem technically becomes more and more complicated because studying the space of solution of a scalar field theory with maybe a crazy potential, it can be tough. So what you actually do is not to, most often, is not to try to you know, these things can develop singularities, can have incredibly complicated behaviors, field theories. So what you do is to say, oh, let me focus on a color neighborhood of my sigma and check how to give a well-defined initial boundary, initial value problem for an amount epsilon of time. It might develop divergences at late times, but as long as I can make sense of things in a small neighborhood of my boundary, maybe I'm happy enough. And so usually this is what is practically done. But here we're not. I just want to warn that this story is actually pretty complicated if you want to run it completely. So I'm being a little sketchy, and this is the sort of things that one would, if one wanted to be extremely rigorous, one would have to take into account. But before closing, let's look at the gauge theory and see what goes wrong.
But this isomorphism is there because going on shell doesn't change the kernel or something, right?
No, it does change. So the kernel here, it does change, except that you would find, so the space of initial conditions for I'm not sure what how can I rephrase it better. So then what I just said, I can try to repeat it, but I'm not sure.
What also
matters is the group
action on the phase space. Okay.
Sorry?
What also matters is the group action on your phase space.
Here there's no group action.
You can also gauge a free particle, for example, make it a gauge theory.
Well, you can try to do the exercise for the parameterized particle. That's quite instructive. There are surprises for the parameterized particle, and they're not the. And the point is, it doesn't quite behave as a gauge theory for some magical reason. But so here is not gauged. Here I'm taking the more naive story of a particle written in the usual way. I'm not gauging it. But if you gauged it, you would find that you would fall on the same phase space, actually. So I suppose that I think it's easier to see what goes wrong in a gauge theory, and then you realize that there can be more going on, but instead, the story is very simple. I don't know, and I do not have an a priori reason why it should work this way, to be honest. It is an observation that in this theory it works, and we can see what clearly goes wrong in the gauge theory case. I do Maxwell, but Young-Mills is very similar. You put covariant derivatives in a few places and things work out. Okay, but. So in this case, let me start from the action. Well, I should start from field space. Field space are the one forms on M. And the action is given by star F wedge F, where F is dA, or, well, 1/2, which is the same as you painfully computed of 1/4 F mu nu F mu nu. Now, what is omega? Omega is star dF wedge dA, sorry. And again, this was in the tutorial, so I will not try to rederive it. The idea is that this is just dA, so there is one derivative. These two terms are actually symmetric, so you can, when you take the variation, integrate by part one of these d's, and you get the symplectic potential as star f delta A, and then you take another variation, star delta f delta A. Then omega sigma becomes the integral over sigma of star f
which has to be thought as a function of A, of course. Sorry, again. Wedge delta A. So at these points, it's best to put indices, and so I go back. I carry also a tensorial notation over here. So this is delta F 0i of A wedge dA, where F 0i is,
well, I cheat a bit, just otherwise we would go a little crazy with the covariant derivative. So let me just say that this is roughly AI dot minus the gradient of A naught. So there might be, if you're in curved space-time, there might be correct, like small tweaks, but it's good enough. So we see that we have, this looks like what we had before. Now there is this weird thing over here. So there are two remarks. First remark is A naught only appears inside the electric field. So this is the electric field component, right? So zero.
Well, I don't want to call it
E just yet. So A naught only appears
mixed with A dot.
It doesn't, you see, already naively, you see that there is something weird. This is not, it's not appearing on its own on this side. And second, related, A dot does not appear alone. AI dot does not So does this really matter? So 2 doesn't really matter that much, and A naught, it just, well, I'm trying to rush ahead, so sorry about that. Let's rewind for a second. So let's do presymplectic reduction, and this will have some consequences for presymplectic. So, okay, what I wanted to say is the following. There is you might have heard, if you have ever done the canonical analysis of this action, that A naught does not have a conjugate momentum, right? So this is analogous to the usual statement that if you do dl over dt A naught, you find zero, right? It never appears A naught dot. And this usually means that A naught is a Lagrange, you say, oh, it's a Lagrange multiplier. It just appears on its own. So when you vary it, you're imposing the Gauss constraint. Now, these are related facts, but it's not necessarily how I want you to think about it in this context. So to do this, to tell this story, you need to pick a foliation of your M. You need to have a notion of what T and A naught are everywhere inside your manifold. To run this other story, you just need to pick one sigma.
not an entire foliation. So it's a slightly different situation. So you can make sense of these just for one sigma. To make sense of that part of the story, you need the entire foliation. So they are related because, of course, we're playing with the same objects, but they're not precisely the same. So let me write it here. But for these, one needs a foliation to split a mu into a zero AI at all t. Whereas here we don't need any of that. Okay, so this is what I wanted to mention. So if you do presymplectic reduction, since I don't have a lot of time, we can guess the result. The result is that we identify, and it will be kind of obvious, all a mu's of T and X, such that, in the same notation, according to, they are MUX is the equivalence class of MUX and T. MUX and T, such that. So what are the conditions? The first condition is that AI is fixed. So we say AI X at T naught, so on my surface. So let me write it in this form. AI is given by some little a, which is just defined on sigma. So sorry for the change of notation. So this is a 4D. So this is a 4D point, but now becomes a 3D point. And the other thing is that they need not to have a dot. A dot that doesn't matter anymore is the combination that matters that they want to keep fixed, because it's the one that appears in the symplectic structure. So, and the other object is all the F0A at sigma to be equal to each other, and I call them maybe curly. Which is a density on sigma, a vector value density. Because this is a vector, this is a density, so this is a vector value density. So. Vector is this part, and density is this part. So if you want, is the densitized electric field. EI is HE densitized so for Maxwell. These are the AI. For convenience, I will work with E, but it doesn't. Let's write it like this. Is this thing, which is T star of omega 1 of sigma. Okay, so an omega of Maxwell
is the integral of d epsilon ix wedge d aix.
You see, if I want to pull out square root of h, if gravity is not dynamical, I can. If gravity is dynamical, I better keep it attached to epsilon and have it as a single object. Anyway, the message here is that of shell we get space. So here there is no a dot. So this is just the space-like connection. I don't know if space-like is the right space-like one forms or connections. It would be more precise, but on sigma. A naught has disappeared. Presymplectic reduction has taken care of removing A naught for us. And electric field. But we know that the electric field must satisfy the Gauss constraint. And here is where I stop. So this cannot be equal to the on-shell phase space because of the Gauss constraint. Because on shell, and this is the same as writing di. Okay.
If you want to write it like this.
What's different in this case compared to scalar field? Because here we need to impose Gauss constraints separately, but in case of scalar fields, presymplectic reduction makes the p's and q's follow the equation of motion naturally.
Yeah. So what is different is the fact that why is this happening? The reason this is happening is the following. If I write and in Maxwell there are no extra terms, so for Q psi sigma. If we look at the tutorial or elsewhere, we know that this is given by,
square root of h I xi plus boundary term, which we throw away because we are looking at the case where d sigma is zero, so we don't have to worry about those things. And this is the Gauss constraint. So I should write it, as fi. So here I'm covariant, but when I pull back, I get in terms of f, this is Gauss.
And when I do,
if I project this equation down along the symplectic, the presymplectic reduction, this becomes, I keep calling it rho, although it should be a slightly, it's a different map because it acts on a different space, but it doesn't matter too much. Omega sigma becomes omega. and this becomes d of sigma square root, well, if you want, just diai psi. And you know, this is by Noether essentially.
We know that the bulk part of, like, the charge which generates a local symmetry vanishes on shell. So this is the problem. We know that this
essentially by Noether.
And so it's clear that we haven't reduced completely when with respect to the on-shell phase space. And this is exactly the problem. So if we were doing it on the right-hand side, we would end up, in a sense, lower. We would reduce at the same time the fact that we're looking at, you end up on a different space because you're imposing more conditions that you would not see. So these are called constraints. The constraints are equations of motion that have a leftover impact on the off-shell phase space. So this is maybe a good place to end. So constraints in general, maybe write in white, otherwise it's invisible. And the Gauss constraint is the prototypical because it's simple and ubiquitous. Are equations of motion which have a leftover impact on P of omega of. So if you want, this is exactly what, and they're always present in the case of a gauge theories, always present in gauge theories because of Noether 2. Which says that J psi on shell is equal to some C plus some boundary term. And this vanishes on shell. So this is the content of Noether 2. Well, when I call it Noether 2, it's a bit sloppy, but you know what is what we derived in that series of lectures. It's one of the consequences of the fact one has that J has to be conserved, but I have to conserve it for every possible psi. So the only way that it is conserved, since psi is so arbitrary, is that it's zero, essentially. That's a rough idea, in fact, behind the proof of the theorem. Right? Because I take the divergence, I get this, the divergence of this times that, plus vice versa. But since psi and its derivative can be whatever, the only way for that to be always zero for every possible choice of psi is that the coefficient vanishes. So this is what's going on in gauge theories, and so that's why. So the moral, and then I'm already super late. To conclude is that working in F bar is hard because it's this super abstract space of solutions of equations of motion, and studied in solution spaces can be extremely hard. So one would like to work on an hypersurface. The obvious candidate is these of shell spaces because they're easy to compute. Like, you do it literally. This is the computation. There's not much more to it. You just check what is left over. You give it a different name because roughly you have to to be a bit more careful in certain situations, but not, it's not hard. It's an easy procedure. But then if you have gauge symmetries, you realize, oh, there's something, probably something going to miss. So this phase space is also, this is something I haven't mentioned, they're always cotangent bundles because they come from a Lagrangian theory. So it's like doing the particle case, but for a field, you're not looking at the symmetry, so you always find P delta Q of something, but by the way you're constructing them. Not 100% of the time, if sigma were null, things would be slightly different, but as a rule of thumb, you expect to get cotangent bundles, which are easy to quantize. And then you can say, okay, let me quantize E and A as these non-commuting operators that give you the bracket gives I. But now you have to deal with the Gauss constraint in a gauge theory. So the job is done, at least at formally, when you are dealing with particles, scalar fields. But as you learned in the QFT class, you have to deal with this extra stuff in gauge theories. But doing it directly in F, bar F would be doing it in the path integral, like BRST in the path integral and stuff like that. If you want a canonical quantization, then you would have to most likely go to P off, quantize P off, and try to impose the extra conditions in P off. So if you want a Hilbert space, and not just a path integral where you compute expectation values, you really want a Hilbert space for some reason, then you most likely have to go through this. At least is the standard route to take, to go take the off shell and then impose the constraint quantum mechanically. So we will not do it quantum mechanically, we'll stay classical, but that's why this is playing a role, and we will see that in gravity the situation is even more complicated than in young Newtons. And that's for the last lecture.
So if you look at the diagram, in case of gauge theories, the isomorphism does not hold true. We have to go there, like on shell, and then do symplectic reduction too.
Yeah, so you can stay in P off, then you take the constraint, you impose the constraint, now it's degenerate again, so you need to do another reduction step.
What is right, your form is F0i?
Oh, because there is it's n.
I should have maybe written it like this.
Yeah. I is a free index.
I is an index on the surface. Yeah. Because you know this is anti-symmetric, so this cannot be in the same direction as n. So it must be in the other. You see it from here. This is the pullback of A. So only the pullback of A matters. It's easier to see from here which A matter. It's the A with the indices associated to the surface itself. It's a pullback. And here you just work out what this is. And this is something of this form. So there are pros and cons of working with forms or not. You can say also that instead of working with this densitized object, you can say that E is a form and is the pullback. Well, this relationship here would be the pullback of F, of star F. Sorry. To the surface. Right? And then you, instead of calling it a density, you call it a top form on sigma. But it's the same thing. Densities and top forms are. Once you have a volume, you can switch from one to the other.